You're listening to Practically Ideal.
You gotta be practically ideal instead of just ideal.
Ready for some podcasting.
Oh, Logan, you got any better, man?
All work and no play.
Welcome to Practically Ideal, the podcast for idealists who like to keep it practical. I'm Logan Bowe, podcasting from Brooklyn, New York. I'm joined again by the one, the only, Bob Caswell, not in Seattle, in the Bay Area. How are you, Bob?
I'm good. Yeah, I was wondering how we're going to say that. I guess that is where I am. I am in the Bay Area, and I'm doing well.
Good. Today we ask whether video games can be art, and we consider a few recent video game examples. We also get Logan's full review of the HTC One. We'll also hit on LinkedIn and company phones. And, of course, we'll give you the usual dose of pop culture, technology, and whatever else is on our minds. All this week on Practically Ideal. Let's rock! Oh, man, it's nice to be back with you, Bob. How have you been?
It's been a while. Yeah, I guess not that long. What, 2 or 3 weeks? But it feels like the podcasting part of my life has been noticeably absent, and I'm ready to get back into it.
Awesome. Well, we are happy to have you back. So let me go to the usual. Do anything fun recently?
Yeah, I saw a couple of movies this weekend. That's another thing I got back into. When you do a move, everything sort of gets paused in your life.
Sure. And
I know it's a first world problem, but just there's a backlog of media I want to consume, and I end up just forgetting about it and moving on and consuming the stuff that's relevant and in front of everyone for the particular weekend. That's what I did this weekend, is I saw two movies that are both relatively new, rather than like go back and catch up on anything I missed in the last few weeks where I haven't done any of that. So I saw The Great Gatsby and Iron Man 3.
Hmm. Okay, those are two pretty big culturally significant movies out there.
Yeah, and they were both on my list from a few weeks back, my whatever we called it, movie preview list of movies I was going to see. So I didn't lie. I saw them.
So what did you think?
I liked both of them. I gave them both a 4 out of 5 on the Netflix / Bobometer. So
nice.
Both for different reasons. I mean, Iron Man 3 is a comic book movie. It's just a lot of fun. It's not too deep, but it's got great pacing, and it's just witty, and Robert Downey Jr. is his Robert Downey Jr. self. Lots of fun eye candy, special effects, and it's just a fun ride. I thought Ben Kingsley and Guy Pearce, who were both villains in different ways, and I won't give away too much because it would be a little bit of a spoiler, but there's... There's some creative takes on the classic comic book villain that I thought were clever, and it was a fun ride. It, ultimately forgettable, but great for in the moment. And I'd say it's the best out of the three. I gave the other two Iron Man movies 3 out of 5 because they both felt more generic. This one felt a lot better than them. So
Okay. So I feel like I know a fair amount of people who think of the Iron Man movies as one of the better superhero movie franchises, but you've been lukewarm about it so far.
Yeah, I think they're right on. They're like middle of the pack, to be honest. I'm more of an X-Men fan. I think they're at the top, Iron Man 3 is just kind of in the middle with a bunch of others like Spider-Man, and I also like Batman a lot more, personally, so I'd say the new reboot of the Batman franchise is much better.
That said, this was the best of the three.
Yeah, there you go. And then, the other movie, The Great Gatsby, based on that book that we all were required to read in English class in 9th or 10th grade or whatever. all meaning those of us who grew up in the U.S. It was fun and an interesting take on a classic tale. The Roaring Twenties. It was directed by the same dude who did Moulin Rouge, and that's kind of very obvious from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Very artsy and with a lot of flair, and just these grandiose parties. That's kind of the theme of the movie, and it was done very well, very high production value, and the acting was great. And I loved the cast of characters, both the the characters themselves as portrayed by the actors, but then the actors chosen, the casting was really well done, with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire in a non-annoying role, which is a lot, you know, to ask of Tobey Maguire. So I was happy with it. I felt like it ran a little too long. It was like 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it's a short book. It could have been tightened up a little bit, but overall it was it did the story justice and was a good portrayal of a classic book.
Nice. So I was going to see a movie this weekend, but it turned out that Amy had to work a lot. She doesn't usually have to work all weekend, but this weekend she did. And I know next weekend is going to be Star Trek for us. That's certainly yes. a higher priority. But if I were in the future to go back and see one of these two movies, which has the higher, let's say, cultural broccoli factor? Which one is going to be more important as an American to have seen?
Is it too much of a cop-out for me to say that they're almost like equal with each other for very different reasons? Because The Great Gatsby has this, you know, it's relevant because of the economic times are repeating themselves. There's like kind of this undertone there of like, oh, it's the Roaring Twenties, and F. Scott Fitzgerald really hit the nail on the head with economic disparity, wealth disparity, and the ruling class and race issues, and now we've come full circle and it's relevant today. And then they even have some of the music is like infused Jay-Z type stuff from this decade that that's combined with the 20s. And so there's a lot of like interestingness from that perspective that you could pretend is more than just pop culture, but it feels very pop culture-y. But then Iron Man 3 is like the opening, the box office, the season opener for superhero movies, which in and of itself feels almost more relevant in some ways. So very different reasons to see them for cultural broccoli purposes. But it's hard for me to pinpoint which one would be more relevant. Is that making your life too hard? It's like, ah.
No, I mean, not as helpful as I would like. I mean, I could have
figured that much out on your own.
Yeah, I've struggled with how they're both seemingly equal on my own. But all right. We'll see if I go see one of those in the future.
All right.
So one of the things I did recently was I went to this thing, Smorgasburg, which is this thing in Williamsburg where all these different food restaurant vendors, they set up in this area of Williamsburg right on the river, and it's a lot of really good food. And I went there, and I found two things. One, wow, there's a lot of great food around here. Two, man, I hate people.
What? Gotta explain that one.
I mean, crowds. It's just not worth it for me to be around crowds, even if it's something awesome.
Really? Wow. So, is it just the type of people? Is it outdoor? Is outdoor versus indoor? Does that make a difference? I'm just curious. Like, so you know, maybe like a nice, classy party would be better for you, or does that matter?
Oh, that's interesting. If we're talking about a party, like if I know people, that's a lot different if I know most of them. I guess it's standing in lines and having to like squeeze past people because there are just tons of people and it's hard to get where you want to go because there's so many people in a little area. Or if you want to go sit down somewhere, you have to scope out a place, the small part of grass or a few chairs or whatever. Yeah. So lines, too many people. It's just not worth it for me, practically anything.
Okay, that helps, because then I think it's more about just the venue being overbooked, which often can be the case when it's an outdoor, come-all-come-any sort of situation. Not to go back to the movie I just saw, but I, you know, when I see these grandiose parties on screen in a very controlled environment, but still a lot of people bouncing up and down and enjoying themselves, and there's seating and drinks for everyone with no lines, I feel like I love people. But how many parties are really like that, right?
Not at our pay grade, I guess.
Right.
But I want to go back to something, and it's not really a crowd if there are too few people there for the venue. I mean, I feel like that's part of what I said originally, that I don't like crowds.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's hard to find. It's like getting the perfect temperature for outdoor activities as well. It's sometimes it happens, but it's hard to get it perfect. Like, you do want a little bit of a crowd, or else it feels like wait, why am I here? This must not be the popular thing happening. But then if it's too crowded, then all those things you described happen.
Yeah, well, and I feel like you're being a little too generous to me, though, Bob. You're trying to soften this and make it sound like I'm just like everyone else. No, I want to come out with a little bit of a stronger statement. I really don't like crowds and being out there with a lot of people, okay?
But you love it, I promise. Let me just convince you some more. No, okay, I see.
Anyway, and so it's a fun thing to have done occasionally.
But you're done.
But, I just, the whole time I'm thinking, man, I want to get out of here. Anyway, that was a little thing I did just a week or two ago. But Bob, you just got a new job. How is it, by the way? Happy where you are?
Oh, I think so. It's only been a week on the job, so I haven't really contributed as much as I've consumed, if that makes sense. I'm sort of getting up to speed and getting to know people. Everyone's really nice. It's kind of the honeymoon stage, but it's a different pace and a different business area for me, and I don't want to bore people, but I'm really looking forward to it. So far, it's going really well, and I did get a brand new laptop.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, and you know they had a few to choose from, and for the first time in my life, I went with kind of more of an ultra portable, ultra mobile sort of thing, and it's kind of embarrassing to be honest because I should have done this years ago. I've been known to always go for like the power laptop that's weighs 7+ pounds and has the better graphics card and screen resolution and all this stuff, and I always think like I need this because what if I'm traveling and I want to play, you know, some awesome computer game, and then like I never did that for like 5+ years. So and it, as it turns out, you can get a lot of power concentrated in these little ultrabooks. It's really nice. So it is the Toyota of laptops. You know, it's a Lenovo, and my wife's reaction to it speaks, you know, volumes for how exciting it is for a consumer. Just looking at it, it's like, oh, I would never want one of those.
I like the look of my Lenovo, huh?
Oh, really? Well, mine looks very like utilitarian. Like it's very designed to be functional and get things done, but there's like no, there's no design about it that's, I don't know, maybe your Lenovo is a consumer line and this one's a business line for all I know, but this one is just very like boring looking, but it's a practical, it's you know, sticking with our theme, I suppose, it's practically ideal. It's almost there, and it's very practical. It does everything I need it to do. It has a solid state drive. It boots up really fast. Everything about it is just super functional. It's really small, but of course I plug it into an external monitor, you know, 90% of the time I'm using it, so that doesn't really matter. And then when I do need it on the go, it's like, you know, 3.5 pounds. So I don't know why it took me like 5 years to join the mobile laptop revolution, but here I am for the first time without like a super heavy laptop. So I'm happy with it.
Oh yeah, if you move your laptop, you need it to be small. I don't know. I think that's the case. That's it's just so much better than any other features you get. Tiny.
Yeah, and one thing, I was going to get a new laptop at my old job, but that didn't happen before I left and switched to this new job. And that one was going to be like a new touchscreen based one, and it was going to be interesting to see how that type of experience would play out. But now that I'm back to just an ultra, just a classic laptop that's mobile, I'm feeling like, oh yeah, I could get something with a touchscreen nowadays, and it just doesn't feel like it's as relevant as I thought it might have been. Of course, I haven't actually tried that approach yet. We'll see if that takes off for other people. But
yeah, without having done it myself, I sort of feel like that's the case too. anyway, but it'll be interesting to... No, I don't know. I'll probably just cut that out. I don't know what I was going to say. all right. So, do you have a gut check on how you like the Bay Area yet?
Love it so far. The weather is gorgeous. Again, it's the first week, but I love the restaurant selection. And not when I say restaurant, I use that term loosely. Evan and I really kind of like finding, this is going to sound snobby, I don't know how else to put it, but like upscale fast food, is that a term? Like we don't
fast casual.
Fast casual, is that what we, is that what to
probably
call, okay? Like, we don't like to find the nearest McDonald's necessarily, but we don't necessarily like to cook every meal either, because that's a pain in the ass and there's a lot of cleanup involved. But we don't want to spend a lot of money by going to a steakhouse for every meal. So I feel like I'm over-explaining this, but the Bay Area has a lot of fast casual places that are really nice that I didn't know existed, and they're all around me, and I can walk to a lot of them where we live, and the weather here is gorgeous. It's always in the 70s. Loving it so far.
Cool. So just think about fast casual. I don't know if it's worth circling back around.
Let's do it.
What do I think of as fast casual? So I think of it as a place where you don't really have a waiter. You sort of go up and get your food, but it's... But drive-thrus are probably less common, though I wouldn't necessarily say that excludes it. And it's just a little bit nicer. You probably pay a tiny bit more, but it's a little bit nicer. So something like Chipotle is like right in the sweet spot of fast casual. Is that sort of like what you're talking about?
Bullseye. We've eaten at Chipotle like 3 times
since
being here. Or I shouldn't say... Yeah, maybe 3 times. But there's a lot of other places that are like Chipotle-like that either I just didn't know existed or maybe they're only in the Bay Area. Like, one is called A Key, and it's like a weird spelling, like A Q U and then like 3 other vowels, I don't know. but it's this salads with chicken or pork and fruits and nuts and kind of tailored specifically to me, honestly, because I try to avoid carbs more or less, and so having a salad with some good protein and lots of variety, but it is a place where you just kind of order up front, and then they do bring you your food, but you don't have a waiter in the traditional sense.
I think that's fast casual.
Yeah, and there's a couple other cafes that do like soups and sandwiches that like I just became the mayor on Foursquare because we've eaten this other place like 3 times called Eric's Deli.
Awesome.
And it's been great.
Good. So, got your new job, and I'm imagining this. So, there you are, doing all your new job things.
Okay.
You know, learning where the bathroom is, figuring out who to avoid, figuring out which fast casual place to go to, stuff like that. Am I getting this right so far?
Yep, exactly.
Okay. And you're going down the list of new job things to do, and you come to updating your LinkedIn profile. So, you do that, and while you're at it, you let LinkedIn check. I'm imagining this, but I imagine you let it check your email contacts, Twitter maybe, Facebook probably.
Uh-huh.
And it shows you some people, and you throw an invite their way.
Yeah.
Now, one of these people was me, Bob.
Isn't this funny? You know...
No. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, just to correct you slightly, I didn't actually do the email import thing, but it's true. I went to update my profile, and LinkedIn never... It never escapes them to have another moment to be like, are you sure you're not wanting to connect to these other people you probably know? And your name kept like floating to the top of the list on every refresh page. And I'm like, I swear I'm already connected to him. And then I'm like, maybe it's just because in life I already am. Like, I don't need like a freaking social network to tell me that, you know, we've done business together and been friends since we were 14.
Well, yeah, I mean, that surprised me too. Well, for 2 reasons. I mean, for one, you're right. How weird is it that you and I aren't already connected on LinkedIn?
Yeah.
But that comes to the second thing. At some point in the last, year, LinkedIn has been making a big push to become relevant. I don't know if I should say relevant again or just relevant in the first place. But what's the word on LinkedIn these days, Bob? What's cool about it?
You know, I'm glad you brought this up because I think relevant again is a good way to put it, because LinkedIn had its initial glory days maybe, you know, a few years back, but it was very concentrated to like wannabe business people / I guess real business people. But I always felt it was like you know, when I was getting my MBA, but this was 2006 to 2008, that was like one of the things you did, like, oh, is your LinkedIn profile, are you networking in LinkedIn? That's appropriate way to network. And I'm like, everybody on LinkedIn seems like they're unemployed because they're not actually all the people I'm connected to are like MBA people or global visionaire strategists. And I'm like, what does that even mean? And why is there no company associated with it? But nowadays, even employed people, like everyone I know, seems to be on LinkedIn. It's like a good cross-section of all the people I know on Facebook are there. And yeah, if you have a job or if you've had a job, you want to be there. And it has some weird things that somehow it gets away with doing because it's in the shadow of Facebook. Like, for instance, you can see who's viewed your profile and they can see that you viewed their profile. You can disable these settings, but like, imagine if Facebook did something like that. The world would stop for that week or whatever. But like, LinkedIn does like these shenanigans all the time and nobody seems to care.
Well, I care. That makes me not want to go explore on LinkedIn. I'm like, ooh, I don't know if I want people to get notified that I've been looking at their profile. Not that I'm trying to stalk them or anything, but I just feel slightly weird about that. Am I alone there?
No, you're not at all. In fact, there was a really interesting article this past week. I'll have to look it up. Sorry to cite something not very well, but it was this guy who kind of did some research about how, like, it's... They always show you, like, people who looked at these profiles that you're looking at might have looked at these profiles. And he's like, it's weird how there's always somebody very attractive in that list. And if you if you click on the attractive profile and you're like, oh, yeah, she's kind of good looking. And then it'll be like people who looked on this profile. And then, like, the looked at column that's referencing what you're looking at in the moment, the attraction level keeps ratcheting up until you're like looking at models. And I just thought it was funny that he documented the whole thing. And then he's like, oh shit, now somebody could like trace that this is all I've been looking at if they but it was for science. It's, you know, it's just kind of funny how anyway, so I don't know what that means or what we're trying to tell the people out there, but LinkedIn does have some weird inappropriate utility perhaps that people don't want to talk about. I don't know.
So I'm at the tail end of, you know, winding down my law practice, so I have to start thinking about whether I should put some effort into updating my own LinkedIn profile. But what I want to ask you along these lines is, though, Bob, do you know of anyone who's, like, drawn value from it? Do people actually network on LinkedIn?
Oh, yeah. Like, I'll admit it. I used it, this career change that I just went through ended up not happening as a result of LinkedIn, so let me not overstate my points. But at the same time, I was using LinkedIn and was able to get a lot of interviews and direct connections with key people for positions that I was interested in at certain companies. And so, and it was much more useful than any of the other typical sites like your Monsters or your Career Builders or whatever. Granted, I paid for that. That's not a default usage, but it's implied that it's kind of the upsell. It's the freemium model, right? So you have your free profile and it looks good and people can find you theoretically, but not until you pay them. I think I paid like $20 a month for a few months while I was interested in looking at other career options. But once you pay that fee, then you're able to like connect with people directly. It's like legitimized spam. You can literally email through their system random people and be like, hey, because we're both on LinkedIn, you have to respect me, rather than like an email out of the blue using regular email or whatever. And people seem to like get this code of conduct. They're like, oh yeah, sure, I'll give you the time of day since we're doing this on LinkedIn. I'm like, really? Oh, okay. So it's a decent business model. I don't know if that's how they make all their money or what else they're doing. I haven't researched them that much, but it feels like they're this bizarro spin-off of Facebook, because it's like a social network, but it's not supposed to be for fun. It's supposed to be professional, but wait, how does that work? A social network that's for business people? I don't know. It feels like there's lots of potential for creepiness factors to happen, but what do I know?
All right. Well, okay. Since you have drawn some value with it, I'm going to do this right now, even as we speak. I'm going to accept your LinkedIn connection on the air.
Oh, you hadn't already? What, you were like questioning? You're like, do I really want to be connected to Bob? What does that mean?
Well, I was wondering if I wanted to... It felt very symbolic of legitimizing LinkedIn as a thing.
No, I hear you. And now, we're
because
legitimized.
If we weren't connected, then how important could LinkedIn be in our lives? You know what I mean?
Ah, I see. I'm with you. Yeah. Now I almost want you to like unconnect. Just, you know, it's like, remember back in the day, if people who know us well maybe know this story, sorry to bore you, but how like I still haven't seen the movie Titanic because I on principle I didn't want to see boobs in a PG-13 movie. Now I've seen boobs in like 70,000 other movies since then. But at the time it was like, no, the rating system is flawed, and I'm never gonna watch this movie, even though it's a commercial success and everybody says I should. And I still haven't. But maybe now that we're connected on LinkedIn, I'm gonna watch Titanic too.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I don't know what just happened. The universe, like, hiccuped.
All right. Okay, so, Bob, we've not talked at all on the podcast lately, but we've also not talked about smartphones in a little while.
Yeah.
Now, I am finally in full command of my new HTC One to the point where I can talk about it pretty well. And I understand you are probably getting a new work phone, or you may already have.
Yeah, I've made the decision, but I'll probably receive it next week.
Okay. So, but I feel like this is always an important time. We have to choose a smartphone. So let's talk about your decision here, Bob. Now, your company wants you to have a work phone, I understand. And yep. What's the company phone deal you're working with?
Well, basically, they said you can bring your own device. There are three options. You can get reimbursed for a plan you already have. Or you can bring your own device, and then we'll pay for your service, and it's under our name. Or just sign up for a totally new service and pick from these devices. And the first two options really didn't work out like I was hoping. So first of all, if you're part of a family, which I am, I'm married, then if you want to get reimbursed for something, it doesn't work out if you're on a joint plan and they only want to reimburse you for a single plan. And that didn't seem to work out because they're like, oh, you have somebody else on your plan? Oh, well, then I don't know if we can do this. Like, really? Nobody else has done this before?
Weird.
Yeah, it did seem weird. And then the bring your own device, I have a Windows Phone 8. It's an HTC Windows Phone 8X, which is a great phone. I really like it. And when I said, like, oh, can I just switch to a new plan and bring this phone and you reimburse me for that? And they're like, yeah, sure. Which phone is it? Oh, it's this HTC. It's a Windows phone. I'm sorry, what now? a Windows phone. They're like, oh, yeah, that's totally not supported. When we say bring your own device, we mean like ones that people use. Like, oh. That's not exactly what they said, but the expression on their face is kind of, that's how it came across. And then.
Okay.
So then my third option was just to get a totally new plan and new phone from the options they had available to me. And I decided, you know what? Why not? Why not have a totally new phone and new service? They're paying for it, and it's totally separate. And I think I'm going to keep my existing plan and service because it's a locked-in deal, and my wife's on it, and it's nice to keep those numbers. But I'm going to be one of those guys who has two cell phones.
Dun, dun, dun. So that's interesting. I'm just comparing, you know, my wife Amy's work. So they have bring your own device. Well, it actually paid, reimbursed up to like $350 or something for her to buy her new one. Of course, I wonder if she would have brought a Windows phone. That would have been interesting to see what they would have said. But the other thing is they're happy to work with their family plan.
Really?
Yep. Just bring it in. Oh, let me approximately chop this in half, and there you go. We'll cover that much. Awesome.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting that it confused my company, but whatever.
Yeah, whatever. So, did you... You didn't tell us already which phones you were considering then, did you, or did you?
No, not on the podcast. I did a little Facebook post about it, but it was... The options they had available were the Galaxy S3, which is like a generation ago Samsung Android phone.
Well, the S4 only came out like a couple weeks ago. But yeah, you're right. It still is last generation.
Right. But it's like watching Iron Man 2 when Iron Man 3 just came out.
Sure.
Then there was the Galaxy Note 2, which is the ginormous phablet phone, which is gets great reviews, and it has a stylus, and a lot of people love it.
Everyone loves it.
Yeah. And then the iPhone 5, which is the latest iPhone, was the third option. And then I neglected to... to mention that the BlackBerry Z whatever, is it Z10? I don't know.
It is.
It was also an option, but like I didn't even bring it up in the Facebook post because I just like ruled it out before I even asked for people's opinions. But now on the podcast, I'll bring it up just because I guess it is a legitimate option for me, but...
Well, so many things to talk about there. I want to hit that Z10 first. Why is it, like, not even a serious consideration for you?
Well, because of the ecosystem, mostly. It could be a gorgeous piece of hardware, and it could have some slick, out-of-the-box user interface type stuff. But it's all about Apple and Android in terms of ecosystem, and to their credit, Microsoft is doing a great job, actually. They came in late, but now they've had a couple years, and they literally have 95% of all of the popular apps, but the long tail is maybe missing by comparison. So if I'm already having to, like, convince you that the Windows Phone ecosystem is a formidable third player, then just imagine what that means for BlackBerry. They got nothing when it comes to apps, in my opinion.
All right.
So that's why I would just ignore it as an option.
So it sounds like you're thinking of this as being like a complement to your overall smartphone fun for pleasure aspects too, not just for work.
Yeah, I think so. It feels like if I'm gonna get something as a freebie, I may as well be plugged into what's going on out in the world, if I have the option to be, rather than go with an underdog that I already have an underdog in my Windows Phone, and I actually really like it, but I don't need a second underdog to continue to miss out on what everyone else is talking about when it comes to Android and Apple devices.
Okay. And that makes total sense. I have to say, I would be pretty tempted in that situation you're in to try that Z10. I'm just really curious about what good it is as a device. Mm. But, you know, obviously there are downsides.
Right.
So, okay. So you got your Android or your iPhone. Now, the way I see it, the upside of the iPhone is, you know, it's the latest flagship device, I suppose. And, you know, it's an iPhone. There's something to be said for it. And I still think you were a little bit Titanic LinkedIn in your view of iPhones before.
I love it.
And so I'm kind of excited for you to get an iPhone just to see what it's like, even though I've moved on feeling like the iPhone moment has passed. You've never had one. So I think it's good. You should have one once in your life.
Yeah, I think you're right, even though I feel like, no, I want to get something when it's relevant in the beginning, not at the end of its cycle or whatever. But
sure.
But whatever.
Yeah, but it's not like your other choices really make up for it on that front.
Yeah, and there are a couple other factors that made me go iPhone, maybe that are specific to me, but I feel like mentioning them. For one, in my previous job, I did a lot of game testing on the iPad mostly, but a lot of those games are compatible on the iPhone. And so I have associated with my Apple account, I guess, my iTunes account, like literally over 150 games. Not that I have tons of time in the day, and am I that likely to go back and play games that I've purchased over the last couple of years? I don't know, but maybe. But it just feels like, oh, I have all this stuff already built in to this Apple device that if I were to get it, that I could just like leverage right away without having to pay for it. So that felt like
somehow the network effect grabbed you in, even though you haven't had an iPhone before. Interesting.
Yeah, kind of weird, huh? It's just one of those things. I felt like I had a second point for why the iPhone wins over Android. Oh, yes, the life cycle of the iPhone, I can't believe I'm saying this, because it used to be that the jokes were made about Apple releasing too many products every year and you being outdated after just a few months. But now Samsung has taken that to the next level. And
oh, yeah.
It feels like this iPhone 5 will outlive any of those other Samsung devices, because I'm likely to be stuck with it for at least a year, maybe two, before my company will, you know, freebie upgrade me or whatever. And that feels like the Galaxy S4 or Note 2 just aren't going to last as long as the iPhone 5 in terms of relevance.
I think that's right. And the Note 2 maybe, I don't know. But I just cannot get over, I know I'd feel like a douchebag just holding that thing up to my ear.
Right, cause it's so massive. And I really want the phone you have, which I know we're going to get to, but if they did have that Android phone, then I would have totally gone for it, but they didn't, so oh well.
Or I got to say, the Galaxy S4 would be another no-brainer choice, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. If it wasn't the S3 that is already like at the end of its 6-month, you know, window of value.
So I have two more things to say. For one, one other thing I'm really happy about you choosing this iPhone about is we're going to have like a shared reference point. That we will both have had an iPhone 5. It's like by the transitive property of smartphones, we'll be able to plug in all our rankings and have them make sense compared to the iPhone 5, whatever we talk about in the future.
No, I hear you. It's like, okay, now that we know the length of these two sides of the triangle, we can agree on the third side.
Exactly. The other thing, though, is I can see why in your exact situation you wouldn't have considered this, but blah, blah, blah. Let me just give a hypothetical here.
Okay.
Let's say you hadn't gotten your new phone. It's been, what, 5-6 months since you got your new phone, something like that?
Yeah, that's about right.
You have your family plan, which they couldn't really accommodate very well. If that had been different, like if you'd had your phone for like over a year and they would have been more accommodating for a family plan, would you have considered maybe buying your own phone and bringing it?
Yes. If there was an option for them to reimburse the cost of the device, then I was at an upgrade cycle moment where that expense wasn't going to hit me head on, then yes, I would have considered getting a new device. Did I answer that question? Did I answer the question you asked?
You did.
Okay.
Because my first thought when you presented me that was, I would totally buy my own device. But seeing those few things sort of explained to me why you wouldn't. And so I just wondered if it had been different, if you would have considered that. Sounds like you would.
Yeah, I mean, phones are expensive. And even this one that I've only had for 4 or 5 months, I mean, it cost me like $500. And the phone that I really want, if I have to buy it without any love in terms of subsidies or reimbursements, I'm just not in a position where I want to spend another $500. So
it costs you that much?
Yeah. But then Microsoft reimbursed me for part of it. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
Interesting. Does T-Mobile not do the... I feel like this probably is not that interesting on the podcast anymore, but does T-Mobile not subsidize if you pay for a contract or something?
That's the thing. Maybe this is interesting. I don't know. I decided not to pay for a contract because T-Mobile continues to think that their contracts are better than what I already have. But my contract from way back when in 2007 is still like head and shoulders a better deal for me and my wife compared to anything that they're offering now. So no matter what, if I want to sign up for a new contract, it would always cost me more in the aggregate because it would be another $30 per month over a year or two. And that's more money than the upfront cost of the phone.
Oh, okay, sure. That makes sense. I guess the way AT&T does it for me is they just extend my contract. So I'm still on my original iPhone contract,
even though I've
had a million phones since then.
And T-Mobile has this weird thing, I guess, when your contract's so good or old, they're like, well, we're required by law to, like, continue to offer it to you, or they say some disclaimer, maybe that's not exactly what it is, but they're like, you can keep doing that month to month for as long as you want. I'm like, well, I'll extend it, sign me up for another year with this exact contract and subsidize my phone. And they're like, nope, you're month to month or you're going to reset with one of these new contracts that's more expensive. Okay,
so they're trying to get you off it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, interesting. I get it. All makes more sense. It's just yeah, okay, $500 for a phone is certainly a lot more than I've paid. Anyway, okay. Well, let's talk about my HTC One. Well, I've had my HTC One for a few weeks now, and I feel ready to say a verdict. And I'm really happy with it, I gotta say.
I was hoping that, like, you were annoyed in some way, because now my jealousy is sort of ratcheting up a little bit.
Spoiler alert, it's not perfect. It's not flawless, okay. But there's a lot that's cool about it. So here we go. It has a lot of what I loved about my iPhone 5, especially in terms of hardware. It has this beautiful aluminum body and a gorgeous screen. I'm not necessarily all in on the size creep in phones. So this one is up to like a 4.7-inch screen, and it's probably slightly bigger than I'd like, I really have to say. Whereas the iPhone 5 at 4 inches was actually slightly smaller than I'd like. I could have lived with smaller than that. The bigger size is nice when I'm showing some of the video or something, but I really don't like that I have to stretch to reach the far corners of the phone, and it's uncomfortable. I have to do this like shimmy up the back or something to readjust my hands.
I know now, that feeling.
But I'm a large man. I certainly have above average hands, and so I don't think it's because I have small hands or anything. And I just think that for something that's supposed to fit in my hand, I'd just like it to be slightly smaller, maybe around 4.5 inches or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, the irony is there aren't that many phones in that middle ground. It's either like iPhone 5, 4 inches, or everything else Android, 4.7. Like, really? Okay.
Yeah, and I wish there were more in that sweet spot. Or maybe if they can do more to shrink the size of the phone, the space between the screen and the rest of the phone, maybe I could live with a little bit bigger.
Mm.
And I have to say props to the Galaxy S4. I understand that it's got a little bit bigger screen, but actually the dimensions are just about the same as this one, so I definitely applaud that sort of thing.
Gotcha. Okay.
Oh, and just when we're on hardware, the speakers are by far the best I've had on a mobile device. And some of the HTC One commercials even just focus on that one feature, how the speakers are good, and, you know, they're good. I don't think that alone would make my decision for me, but I have to say it is nice to have.
Okay. Yeah, the speaker thing to me is like, feels almost gimmicky, but then again, that's what Samsung and HTC have to resort to, is kind of incremental gimmicky things that don't make or break the phone, but seem cool, right?
Yep. But it's also nice because the phone can go up super loud if you're just using it as a phone, because it has those nice speakers and blah, blah, blah. It's nice, but it's, you know, not a deal maker.
Right.
But probably the biggest difference is that I'm running Android now, in particular the Jelly Bean version of Android.
Yeah, and how does that compare in terms of overall look and feel, and then ecosystem in terms of what, because you've been on the iPhone for a long time, and I wonder if there's anything missing or anything better that wasn't available. Anyway, I'll let you speak.
Yeah, well, what I love, love, love about it is the integration with the Google Suite. I thought I'd like that, and I do like that a lot. You know, Gmail, Google Drive, Google Calendar and Tasks, my Chrome profile, Google Contacts, all that's just like this seamless part of the phone operating system. And it interfaced fairly well with the iPhone. I didn't really have tons of complaints, but it's just nice the way it permeates everything on this Android device.
Yeah, and I have to say, I am pretty well bought into the Google model with my email and Chrome and all those other things. Like, Google's done a good job of being the layer on top of whatever device you're on that, you know, that's most important to you. And I wonder what Apple's going to do about that in the long run, because it feels like Android devices are just going to become more and more relevant the more Google is important to people as their frontline way of connecting with, you know, their services.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened to me. Now that it's just become a mobile terminal for my internet cloud use, then I wanted to be a Google device instead of an Apple device.
Yeah, right. But I guess that still speaks to something that isn't as related to the particular phone choice, because you would have gotten that on the Galaxy S4 too, right?
Sure, sure. But for me, the Android versus iOS change is pretty significant in my review of the phone.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so, yeah, I do like the widgets and just being able to customize it more. I also want to say the it just works factor is pretty high with Android. It's not quite like the iPhone, but from what I've read, Jelly Bean is where Android has finally gotten to be in the same league as the iPhone, and I think I would agree with that assessment.
Oh, good. So that was one thing that was part of my decision of going with an iPhone, is I felt like I don't need another thing to tinker with as much as I need something that out of the box is a solid solution. I mean, as fun as it is for me to get a new gadget, that's not necessarily the main reason to get this new phone for me, and so I didn't want that extra overhead. But it sounds like maybe that's less of an issue than I originally thought.
I think that is less of an issue now. Anyway, so then one of the other big things is this camera that HTC's tried to go a completely different way on, to dispel the myth of the megapixel. And so it lets in a lot more light, and it has a pretty wide angle. And it seems fine. I mean, if you look at comparisons online, It seems to do really well in low light, maybe not quite as well in better light compared to current flagships. But, you know, the cameras are always getting better. I will say that as iPhones kept evolving, my picture taking always seemed to get better with each new generation, and I feel like my phone isn't helping me seem like a better photographer quite as much as with the iPhone, but it seems cool, I guess.
It's funny you mention it that way, because I've noticed this trend of reviewers to, like, not want to ever say another camera matches the iPhone's camera. Even, like, Nokia with its Lumia, this, that, and the other, which is using all sorts of funky special technology, you'll have these people do these side-by-side comparisons and show all this crazy stuff about why the Lumia is so amazing as a camera. And in the end, that it's like, we really can't say. The iPhone 5 camera is probably slightly better. Like, what? Okay, but it's just like this universal truth that nobody can touch the iPhone 5 camera for some reason.
I felt like my pictures were better when I had that camera. That's all I know. It's not a very technical analysis, but I just look at my pictures and think, oh, that was a good picture I took. A lot more with my iPhone 5 than I do with this one.
Right. Okay.
That's about all I have to go on. But they do have a cool feature, a software feature called Zoe. So it just, like, takes this 3-second snap that is even before you hit click. And then you can, like, scroll through those 3 seconds to figure out which exact frame you want to be the picture. And so that actually helps improve my picture some. Like, oh, was blinking there, wasn't looking here, or just whatever. You've got that 3-second window to choose which frame you want. That's pretty cool, I think.
Oh, that is nice. I'd love that, because I end up taking those 3 seconds worth of pictures just manually anyway, so in a lot of cases.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, let's put some practicality in here to balance the cool ideas, though.
Right.
Does it work? That's the question. So, I have to say that while I'm excited about this phone, I don't know that I'd buy it for my wife or my mom quite yet.
Mm.
One slightly weird thing is the HTC skin that they call Sense that's over the top of the Android Jelly Bean. I mean, it's fine and all. And there's this HTC suite of apps for internet, mail, etc. But there's also side-by-side the native Google apps. And it's just a bit weird. And I had to really play with the settings so I didn't get, like, duplicate notifications from the ATC, from the HTC email client and the Gmail client.
Nerd alert, that's like that. That's not an out-of-box experience that normal people want.
Right. So, you know, things like that, they're just... It definitely has that classic Google eternal beta sort of feel. And one of the things that HTC is proudest of, this Blink feed, basically turned off by installing a completely different launcher. I guess what they do is they get your Facebook and your news and your Twitter, and they just put a stream... on your homepage. It looks cool, but for some reason it did, like, too little to meter the Twitter fire hose of my feed, but simultaneously it did too much metering of the Facebook feed, and I couldn't choose the exact news feed I wanted, so it just didn't do it for me, so it's gone.
Okay. You know, incidentally, Windows Phone tries to do something similar, and I use it sometimes, but not as a, you know, wower sort of feature all the time. And so I know what you're talking about, where a device like this, the service tries to guess how to put together information you want to consume, and you're like, nice try, but you only got it about 60% accurate. So
right, something like that. So the bottom line for me is it's a terrific phone, and I would give it enthusiastic thumbs up for all but the most tinkerphobic phone users. Now... But we need to have sort of a meta moment here, Bob.
Okay.
I'm trying to decide if I want to give it the practically ideal stamp of approval. But what do you think about this? What should our standards be? I mean, I sort of feel like if we're giving something the practically ideal imprimatur, that it's like saying this is full-on awesome, it's for everybody, it's a game changer. But
yeah.
Other than that, might be asking for too much.
Right, like an Editor's Choice Award or something. It sounds more like a 9 out of 10 or, you know, a really high score, but I wouldn't put the Editor's Choice Award stamp on it, which in our vernacular would be the practically ideal seal of approval or whatever.
Yeah, can I say you're stupid for getting a Galaxy S4? No, that's also a great phone. And if I were walking in with a fistful of money to Best Buy or wherever you can get a phone, I would still buy for my wife and my mom iPhone 5s. today. You know what I mean? So
yeah, yeah.
So I feel like the original iPhone, that would have been a cool, practically ideal game changer at the time. But no, this one doesn't get that at this point.
You know, that's both good and bad for me. Like, I feel saddened by the fact that there isn't, like, a clear flagship winner that's obvious, that's the thing to have. But then again, that just speaks to the maturity of the market. You know, smartphones now are well into their life cycle, and there's a lot of competition, and it's probably good that there's different iterations of slightly better or slightly better for this person versus that person, even if, like, it makes assigning awards more difficult.
Yeah, well, it'll be all the better when something does get our practically ideal stamp of approval, editor's choice, whatever we're calling it.
It's going to be amazing, whatever that new device is that hasn't launched yet.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's move on. We got one more topic I want to cover today, Bob.
Okay.
A few weeks ago, we had Chris on, and we talked about some recent video games. And something came up in that conversation that I want to explore a little bit more, and that is the question, can video games be art?
Yeah. Where did we leave that? Because my answer would go something like this. Yes?
That's very important. The inclination of tonality there, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, so I ask in the wake of going on a personal video game spree in the last month or so. You know, at your recommendation, I played Bioshock Infinite all the way through. And it felt very much as though, if a video game can be art, Bioshock Infinite might be one of those video games. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it's a flagship product for this new area that we're exploring.
Yeah. So, you know, we covered Bioshock Infinite in our prior episode, but just remind us a little bit about the game, just for some context here, Bob. What's Bioshock Infinite like?
Well, so it's at its heart, it's a first-person shooter, so the premise is going around and killing people in terms of the game mechanic, but then there's a pretty complicated and deep story, at least by video game standards, that's comparable with, I don't know, movies or books or other media types. It's a period piece set in the early 20th century about a dude who's looking for redemption and needing to wipe away debts, and he has to go escort a woman he needs to pick up, but then he meets her and things aren't quite what they seem, and it's the story evolves with you, and there's quite the cast of characters, even though, again, you're running around killing people through the whole thing as part of the premise.
You mentioned that a couple times now. Yes, that's a very important part.
Anyway, maybe that's not a great overview.
No, I would just add that you discover new things about your mission, about the space-time continuum, and about all the characters involved. They continue to evolve our understanding of them as it goes on.
Right. Yeah, and so, there's a lot of themes, you know, that are explored in terms of religion and race and, like, heavy stuff for a video game, right?
Yeah, that's really true. That is really true. And so it certainly aspires to say something bigger about society than just being a first-person shooter.
Right.
Which brings me to this question. What is it that puts it in the putative art category, would you say?
Well, the environments were meticulously created, much like you'd have a cinematographer or a set designer or, you know, costume design. All that same stuff happens in a video game. It's just that it's all digital instead of real life stuff that's being recorded. And
the graphics are beautiful. They're like artistically designed instead of just functional images. And so that obviously helps make it like art.
Exactly. Like, if you think of the movie I just saw, The Great Gatsby, where I talk about it, it's artistic flair and it's showcasing the roaring 20s. There's nothing to suggest that a video game couldn't do the same thing and have all the same types of experts on the payroll that are trying to recreate that part of history. And I think Bioshock Infinite does that just as well as a movie could in a lot of ways. Wouldn't you agree?
It's gorgeous. It looks really good, and so that certainly helps it be art.
Right.
I've got another one. Ultimately, where I feel like it is art, or at least aspires to be art, is because the game is designed to tell a story, rather than the story only being like tacked on at the end to make the game more interesting and playable. So with Bioshock Infinite, we see a video game that is significantly writer-driven instead of only gameplay-driven.
Right, and I think that's where not to make the inverse point, but what I'm going to say is, I think that's the heart of the conflict here, right? Because BioShock Infinite took storytelling to the next level, but it still had the crutch of being a first-person shooter. Now, I don't think video games have quite yet been able to free themselves from that. I don't think BioShock Infinite did it entirely. And what I'm saying is, a game that is not required to follow certain formulas because it's a game. BioShock certainly had the storytelling at the heart of the game just as much as the gameplay aspect, but I still feel like they were pretty equal in terms of relevance to the whole package, whereas maybe True Art would make it so that the story would somehow be more important than the gameplay mechanic. Does that make sense?
Well, it does make sense. In fact, let's sort of transition into that. So, you're right. At heart, it's a video game. It's a first-person shooter. Now, you're suggesting that because it's a first-person shooter, that's an inherent limitation to its artistic value. Is that what
yeah.
I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so, well, let me offer a few pluses, actually. Whether or not this, you know, changes your mind or not, I don't know. But I have to say, I'm not a big first-person shooter guy, but I feel like the gameplay was like this perfect blend of relevant, interesting, inviting, challenging, that it made me personally really motivated to keep playing. So, as a way to keep me invested in the story, somehow the first-person shooter aspect actually helped in that way.
Yeah, I think that's the positive side. I think the negative side is the quite frankly, the body count. Like, you're killing people through the whole thing. And the story, if you think about the amount of storytelling that happens versus the amount of just you killing people, it starts out with less killing. Like, and it's a great introduction, don't get me wrong. Like, the first 20 minutes of the game, you're just in eye candy land exploring a world without killing anyone. But then as soon as the premise gets underway and you get a gun in your hands, the storytelling comes and goes here and there throughout, but it's kind of in a backseat driver, while the front seat is you just killing people, right? And that's the part that sort of diminishes the artistic value in my mind.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I mean, you kill, what, like hundreds of bad guys? Even in war, even in action movies, that's just a lot of people to kill. So it sort of strains the credibility of the story, even if you're already giving a healthy suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, I just wonder, this is an open question for me still, does being a first-person shooter inherently limit the quality of the story that can be told?
That's a tough one. I feel like I'm not at liberty to say, or like research needs to be done, or it feels like the answer is maybe. I don't know how you can create a premise that doesn't have that sort of killing mechanic at the heart of it, if it's to be a game. I do know there are creative ways to have gameplay, but sometimes they're less inviting or more boring, and then you would just as soon have it be a movie where it's more passive and you're not doing something tedious that isn't killing but is still gameplay.
But I'm talking about first-person shooters here. I don't want to. I just wonder if being a first-person shooter inherently limits it.
Then yes, I think so. I think if that's the game mechanic that we're talking about, it's pretty hard to escape the storytelling being not as likely to be artistic because of that first-person shooter mechanic where you just have to have death all around you.
Well, that's pretty significant because first-person shooters tend to be the most money-making genre, the most popular genres, right? So if you want to have a video game that's ambitious, it kind of has to be a first-person shooter if you want people to buy it.
Right, yeah, and I think was it you that pointed out that the creative director of BioShock Infinite even said as much, like, hey, this is what we had to work with. Like, there's no way we could take video games to the next level with some new genre that nobody's ever heard of. It had to be a first-person shooter.
I do remember reading that. Maybe I told you too, but yeah. So that's so. If he's even thinking that, then that is perhaps what disappointing. I don't know.
But, I don't know. It feels a little disappointing, but then again, I mean, it's still a lot of fun, and it is a pretty good story. But I don't think we're quite there yet. And that's why I'm saying my answer is maybe, because I'm pretty sure there's a way to create a story, an artistic piece of work that's story-driven, that's also a first-person shooter, that doesn't still feel like it has this crutch. I just feel like BioShock Infinite didn't quite get away from it. And it's easy for me to say as like this, you know, popcorn critic that somebody else is going to do this. I just have no idea how.
So it's like a stepping stone on the way. It's a dot connected to what will ultimately be an amazing achievement.
Exactly. That's what I think, but we'll see.
So let's talk about the story, the creative aspects. Was the story good, Bob?
Oh, that's debatable. See, that's the other thing, is like you think it's great as you're going through it, and it does a great job of keeping you captivated and involved. So from that aspect, it's good. The ending does have a bit of a twist that we won't really get into.
A bit.
A huge twist, okay? Yeah. And again, in the moment, it's fascinating to live through it and experience it. But I have to say, on further reflection, it's not that amazing. I found some issues with it. I gave it a lot more benefit of the doubt while it was happening, because it was so new in terms of experiencing such a vivid story in you know, the computer game format. But honestly, I've seen movies like this that have similar ways of portraying the story that, you know, at best I give a 4 out of 5, or on average give a 3 out of 5, or whatever. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. But I want to, well, agree that it's mixed on the one hand, but also maybe stick up for a little bit more. So talking specifically about that big shocker twist at the end, and I guess we'll try not to spoil it here. You're right. In hindsight, I feel like there may have been some holes in it, or it hasn't been something I've wrestled with for weeks or anything like that. But at the time, it did make me think, and it made me feel certain things in a way that I think perhaps only a video game could have done, because you identify with this guy so much because it's a video game, because you're making this person's choices. And then what you discover at the end, it would almost be less revolutionary if you're watching it in a movie. So I feel like that was one aspect where they really drew on the video game's interactive components to make it hit harder when they revealed the twist.
That's actually a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think you're right that there is not just a negative side to be debated here of whether or not it can be considered in the same category as movies or what have you, but can it be better? And that is one way that it is slightly better. You wouldn't have had that same emotional connection had you just been watching it passively. Again, I think, like you said, after thinking about it after the fact, it sort of gets diminished with time, and it's not as amazing as it could have been, that connection. But I think it's just the beginning. And if game developers can figure out how to bring that out even more so, then that could be huge, because then that would potentially make it so that video games could become more relevant or more artistic, if you will, than even movies or other forms of art.
Or certainly be, you know, something to be considered in the same category.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say was I really liked the characters. I thought the characters were interesting, and I thought they developed really in an interesting way throughout the game. You learn more about them, you start to feel different ways about them, culminating at the end there. But I thought that was very impressive for a video game.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you slightly there, though, because I felt like in true video game form, they had to create a mechanism through which the story progressed, because not everything, again, when you're running around killing people, you can't stop and talk to somebody directly very often. So they had this mechanism where you'd find recordings and you'd slowly, bit by bit, learn about the backstory through these recordings. And it, as an idea, functionally, it could work well, but I found myself not, and again, this is upon further reflection after playing the game, I found myself not really knowing what was going on with a lot of those middle characters, those stepping stone characters that get you to the ultimate experience of the ending. So outside of like a handful of characters, you, Elizabeth, maybe one or two more, the main antagonist, there's like a supporting cast that almost didn't make sense to me, because I only had half the story because of the way the story was being told.
Okay, I can see what you're saying. I guess my response is, on the one hand, I think you do bring up a real a real sort of structural limitation there, because you go and you find these recordings that you can listen to, and it seems like you have the choice of searching super hard for every single recording so you get the whole story, or you could not care about those at all. But there's not a very easy middle ground. You're like, hey, what if I just want the broad outlines without necessarily obsessing about finding these recordings?
Yeah, exactly. Like, when you just go through the game as a game and you get half of the story, like, you'd never do that as a movie. Like, oh, it's okay if you just, you know, skip the middle. You'll generally get it in the end. Like, well, right. Yeah, it's not as effective.
But I do want to say that I felt like I learned enough about, like, three or four main characters to where I was still impressed with how those characters develop, even if there were other people that I didn't understand quite as well.
Yeah, and for me it's two or three, so I guess three is the common number.
What about those two, the brother and sister who kept showing up? I felt like we started to learn about them too. Are the others there?
That's true. I just learned way more about them reading about them on, you know, the internet after than I did through the game.
Yeah, maybe so. So, what, on the practical idea scale, it gets good points for being a cool idea as a sort of stepping stone to something hopefully better in the future. And grading on a curve, maybe in my mind, it might get points for the practical too, but then you wonder, should we be grading on the curve, and maybe not is the answer.
Yeah, and this falls into the same category as the HTC One for video games, though. It's like, it feels like a 9 out of 10, but not an Editor's Choice Award, or whatever that distinction is, between really good, but not quite almost perfect.
Right. Now, we are sort of taking a lot of time here, but I thought another interesting game to bring up, and at least touch on briefly in this conversation, another recent game, is Max Payne 3, which I have also played and finished, thanks to you sending it over for my birthday.
Yeah, how did you like it?
I liked it a lot. Now, it's a shooter, though it's, I guess, a third-person shooter, so it's slightly different. Just in comparison to Bioshock Infinite, it's even more story-driven. In fact, it's basically a computer graphics movie. It just turns it over to you as the player whenever there's shooting that needs to be done.
Right, and there's a lot of shooting, and the context feels almost more relevant in terms of the shooting being part of the story, as compared to Bioshock Infinite in some ways.
I think that's true, although the body count issue is still there. I mean,
yeah
you know, it's a shooter too, so way more people die than even the most actiony action movies, which again, you know, just has that same issue. But there is a lot of voice acting and even acting. And I think that most of that is pretty good, to tell you the truth. I'm actually a James McCaffrey fan before I saw this, who plays Max. And, you know, he's great as this world-weary but badass former cop.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you liked it, because the irony here for me, and part of the reason I wanted to give this to you as a birthday present, to be in tune with our awesome friendship on this new level. No, I'm just kidding. I just think that it's a better candidate in a lot of ways than Bioshock Infinite for this new tier of video games as art, but it came out like 9 months before, and it didn't get the same level of praise or meta conversation as Bioshock Infinite did. And now, retroactively, I'm like wondering why, and here we are. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm not enough of an expert in the video game industry, but I wonder if the fact that it's not a first-person shooter, that's exactly what the Bioshock Infinite people were worried about. It just would have made less of a splash had it been a different genre.
No, I don't think it's that. Or at least I have a different theory. I think okay. I think the genre is close enough, and third-person action games are in line with first-person. If you take Call of Duty out of the equation, then a lot of these third-person action games can perform almost as well, or pretty close to as well, as first-person games. So my theory is that it was less accessible because it had... It's kind of the rated R versus PG-13 effect. Like, if Lord of the Rings was rated R, then it wouldn't have performed as well. And Max Payne 3 was definitely a rated R video game, even though, even more irony, maybe, I don't know if this is irony, but both Max Payne 3 and Bioshock Infinite got the same rating in terms of the way video games are rated, but Bioshock Infinite is a lot more tame. It just has your basic blood and gore violence from being a shooter, which is more accessible to mainstream America and the world, because there aren't, you know, there isn't nudity and tons of F-bombs and language, whereas Max Payne 3 pulls out all the stops, and it's like hardcore rated R.
So, good point. Here's my counter. Grand Theft Auto.
What about Grand Theft Auto?
that always makes a huge splash. Definitely rated R.
Yeah, but then counter to your counter, that's also a third person, it's not a first person game, right? So, where does that leave us? Neither of our theories.
It's a different genre, certainly, but that wasn't really responding to my counter. That was just saying that mine has the same problem.
No, you're right. Yeah, so Grand Theft Auto was very successful for some reason that didn't have to do with its lack of accessibility. That's a good point. My rated R theory is thwarted again.
No, but I mean, it might be a combination of things. So you're telling me Max Payne didn't like sell big, or whatever? How are we defining not getting as much recognition here? Didn't sell. It didn't get as much critical hand-wringing about it, or what?
Well, so it sold okay, but it didn't sell nearly as well as BioShock Infinite. It got actually really good reviews, but again, it didn't get that extra meta layer of video game as art conversations that not only we have been having, but other people have been having throughout the video game industry and the critics. BioShock Infinite just got a lot more love, and the conversation was bigger, and for whatever reason, now that I look back, I feel like Max Payne 3 just was shafted a little bit. It got good reviews and sold okay, but it didn't get like... It's like Ben Affleck at the Oscars, you know? It's like, what? Why didn't he get nominated as a director? And that's kind of what happened with Max Payne 3.
So the one other thing that I'll bring up here is, even though we decided it was sort of fleeting and in hindsight it's not as cool, that thing, whatever it is I felt at the end of BioShock Infinite, was just a lot more significant than what I felt after Max Payne 3. So it's like Max Payne 3 was maybe better executed, but at the end of the day, it's just like an action movie. And I just, you know, a great action movie is just, it's nice, but it doesn't affect me, and it doesn't deserve the same praise as much as something that's more ambitious.
Oh, I hear you there. That's a good point, actually, because Max Payne 3, the ending, I don't want to go as far as to say as it was disappointing, but it certainly wasn't groundbreaking or that. It was fairly typical, even though, like you said, the execution was really well done, and the storytelling, and you were into it, but then it just sort of ends, and you're like, all right, put down the controller, what's next? It wasn't like, let me think about that.
Yeah, you know? And we both went online immediately on BioShock Infinite, like, we got to make sense of this. We got to talk about it. We got to see what people are saying. Where's Max Payne 3? Ah, that was a great game. Is all.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I wonder if holding all the other variables constant, if that's enough of a reason to sort of make a stance and say, like, you know, endings matter, or maybe that's too generic, but something there is really relevant, and video game makers take note, is what
I
want to say.
Or I don't know if I want to pin it all on the ending, but the ending was obviously important in the overall, you know, story it was trying to tell. Anyway, all right. Well, I guess I don't know if we've come to the answer, but I feel like it's been a good conversation, and it'll be something for us to draw on as we check out video games in the future.
Yeah, and if anything, I'm glad that we brought up Max Payne 3 to be part of the conversation, because as this topic evolves, I think it deserves a seat at the table with BioShock Infinite as being part of this new generation of video games as art.
Mm, cool. All right, well, definitely running long, but you got to do our many obsessions, Bob, so I'll give you mine first, and it is donuts. Oh, Bob, donuts.
So,
on this Tim Ferriss slow-carb diet I'm doing, you get one day to go crazy, of course, and I've been on a mission lately to experience the best donuts I can find in my neighborhood and in the whole city here, and there's just something kind of awesome about donuts, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you, even though I've sort of ruled them out of my life entirely. But I'll listen anyway.
Well, yesterday I made my way to the Lower East Side and had like 5 donuts from this place called Donut Plant. Nice. And oh man, they were so good. They're like, the yeasty ones were like so soft, and they managed to like feel custard or jelly even into the round donuts and have it go all the way around somehow. It was
very
impressive.
Holy cow.
And then some of the flavors I know you would not have liked, like there was this peanut butter cup flavor.
Oh, not
but
good.
But there was like a super good coconut cream filled donut that I bet you would have loved.
I would have loved that for sure.
As I was making plans to go, I even texted up Shannon here, friend of the show Shannon. I said, hey, you want to meet me over there? And so she did, and we all had this nice carb-induced coma together afterward.
Nice.
But the donuts, I just realized I've been going out of my way to find a lot of donuts lately, and I've been loving it.
Love it. Cool. Well, I'll just have to experience it through you, because I gave them
all
up.
All right. Okay, well, what's your mini obsession, Bob?
So my mini obsession, as part of my move, I took the opportunity to purchase a new TV and get it set up, you know, as perfect as possible with the audio-visual hookups and that sort of thing. So maybe it's less of an obsession or whatever. It works. What I'm saying is I took a lot of time this past week obsessing over getting just the right AV balancing with, you know, picture quality and sound. And the big thing nowadays is the soap opera effect and the and well, I don't want to get into all the details. Maybe I'll save it for another time. But balancing getting the best HD picture quality, but not having it be so real that it looks like you're watching a soap opera and you can actually see things behind in high production value movies, you know, behind the actor that make it look like it's cheap.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah.
So it's like finding the right balance of HD. So I think I found the right balance of HD tweakage for my setup, and I'm pretty happy with it.
Oh, cool. That sounds, well, I don't feel like my equipment is high enough end for me to really get a lot out of really tinkering with it on that level, but it sounds like a fun thing to do.
It sure is, and I went with a fairly expensive TV, which I'll maybe save for another podcast, but it was not the top of the line, but in classic, you know, technology purchase style, it was the model right below the top of the line model.
The practically ideal choice.
Exactly. In fact, depending on how this goes, it could get that stamp of approval.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Cool. Cool. Well, that's today's Practically Ideal. Find us at practicallyideal.com and on iTunes and on Facebook and now on Stitcher Radio. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Logan Bow. Bob is at Bob Caswell. Tweet us or leave a comment about this episode or about anything else. Thanks for rocking with us.
Have a good one.
In the field of